Welcome again to the Cannabis Investing Podcast, where we speak with C-level executives, scientists, and law and sector experts to provide actionable investment insights and the context with which to understand the burgeoning cannabis industry. I'm your host, Rena Sherbel. Hi again, everybody. Welcome back to the show. It's great to have you listening with us as always. Today, I am excited to bring you my conversation with Sturgis Carbon, the CEO of Manifest 7, the director and CEO of Manifest 7, a cannabis company that does something a little bit different than we're used to covering on the show. Manifest 7 is a sort of a provider of all the things having to do with a cannabis supply chain, being able to provide that and help companies with that all over California, right now, just in California. And we talked to Sturgis about coming into the cannabis world. He's an entrepreneur, a businessman, and how he got into cannabis, why he decided on this lane of the cannabis industry. A great conversation with a really insightful leader. I hope you enjoy it. Before we begin, a brief disclaimer. Nothing on this podcast should be taken as investment advice of any sort. I am Long Trueleaf, Chiron, Isracan Biosciences, the parent company, Air Wellness, and the ETF MSOS. You can subscribe to us on Libsyn, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Play, and Stitcher. Sturgis, welcome to the Cannabis Investing Podcast. Really great to have you on the show. Excited to talk Manifest 7 and the cannabis industry. A different lane than maybe we're used to talking, but welcome to the show, first of all.
Thanks so much. Great to be here.
It's great to have you. So catch listeners up for those that don't know Manifest 7. Talk to us about where you play in the cannabis industry.
Yeah, so we are kind of a little unique insofar as we're really focused both in terms of the market we serve, which is California, which is the single largest market in the world. And then in terms of what we do, if you follow the cannabis space, there are a lot of companies that have scaled by basically vertically integrating and doing everything from cultivating the plant all the way down to having their own retail stores. We're very focused on just basically distribution, dispensary, and delivery. So effectively the downstream end of the supply chain in a very integrated way. Essentially what we're building is the Amazon of the space in that regard.
Speaking of Amazon in the cannabis space.
That's timely.
I mean, I didn't mean to get to it that quickly, but it is in the news. I don't want to get there so quickly. I'm interested how you came to the cannabis industry in general, kind of how you found your way there, what was attractive to you about it, and how you picked this lane to play in.
Yeah, it's interesting. The whole industry is, I think, to a large extent, kind of an industry of immigrants that have come from, you know, a variety of backgrounds. And I think it's safe to say I never expected to see myself in this space to the extent it would ever even exist. I'm a 20-year recovering background investment banker by background. I was actually running a merchant bank that I was a founding partner in that was focused on alternative strategies based in Los Angeles. And after the kind of mainstreaming effect hit in Colorado, I was approached by just a partner in another business that was looking at, you know, this space. And I think, if just from my personal perspective and looking at it very early on, I think I saw a lot of the upside and just cyclical development that I had seen earlier in my career as a technology investment banker going back to 1999, 2000. Mm-hmm. And so it, you know, kind of the understanding of how the industry would ultimately evolve, both from an industry perspective and a capital markets perspective, was just really interesting. And when you look around, you know, there's not a lot of generational wealth creation opportunities from a growth perspective like this one. And, you know, if your aperture is wide enough, you see it for what it is, which is long-term, ultimately a global opportunity. And I think we saw that very early on when we, you know, started the company almost 7 years ago now at this point.
And how'd you decide to focus on California? And I'm interested in your thoughts about the California market, if you want to talk about that a little bit.
Yeah, of course. So, I mean, California is really interesting. It's the bellwether of the space. It was the first to engage in any kind of legislation to decriminalize the plant. So it is, you know, kind of the standard bearer in a lot of ways. The thing that gets the most attention is the size of the market, and is without question, by almost any benchmark, production, consumption, et cetera, the largest single market in the world. And, you know, and that's really attractive. And so from, you know, scaling an enterprise from startup to growth, that's a fantastic environment to situate yourself in. The flip side of that is California is also the most fragmented. So there are 480 different cities plus in the state. They all have differing legislation around cannabis. You have, you know, a huge amount of tax burden that kind of comes as a result of that, and a lot of latent inefficiencies from an operational perspective, just navigating that fragmentation. So you have this kind of dualistic view of the state. In one regard, it presents the greatest upside and probably the most valuable strategic positioning in the global development of the industry. And at the same time, it's also ironically the most commercially dysfunctional and the most in need of like operational remediation across the supply chain and the ability to unlock some real efficiency so that you can get to scale at a profitable level. And that's one of the harder things to do in California, to ironically.
Yeah, yeah, it is. There's this kind of dichotomy in the market. How do you kind of see it growing as this legalization picture develops? How do you see kind of California growing into that if it's not some wham bam thank you legalization moment where, you know, everything's kind of changed, which clearly probably isn't going to be how it's going to be. It seems to be some sort of rollout that's protracted. How do you see California being affected by this and kind of how it's being already affected by the bigger players coming in and how legal cannabis is already affecting the state? And then also talk about the broader kind of picture in the U.S., how you see that growing and how you see Manifest 7's place within that as it expands.
Sure. So I think that to a large extent, to even address that question, you first have to establish your time horizon. Because there have been a lot of people that, you know, have come into the space, you know, really kind of, I think, driven by the gold rush or the land grab mentality. And there's kind of been this moving goalpost around a first mover advantage in the industry. Mm-hmm. California, if your time horizon is long enough, whether that's, you know, kind of going back a few years through the inevitability at some point of federal reform in the U.S., but even further down the road towards kind of the global I think just normalization of this, and that will eventually happen. So if you're looking long-term enough, California's position is ultimately the queen on the chessboard from a true global perspective. You know, it's first going to start with, you know, reform in the U.S. The interstate barriers come up. When you look at the dominance of this market, just in the U.S., I mean, one of the things, again, going back to the ironies of the state, you know, it's the most prolific state in the union and almost in the world. But still, like 60-70% of what's grown here leaves state lines and supplies the rest of the country right now under the current legal context illegally, right? Mm-hmm. So when those barriers lift, that's not going to change. That's just going to amplify. And then as this starts to, you know, kind of evolve into more of a global supply chain, California, one way or the other, is going to be the epicenter from a supply perspective first across the country when the interstate barrier lifts. And to a large extent, you already have that validated by the fact there's still the majority of the product that's grown here leaving state lines illegally anyway. And there's a reason for that. It's the best product in the world. Everybody understands that, and there's demand for that. And that's not going to change when the interstate barrier lifts. It's just going to accelerate. And it's going to make California an even more important source market. And then as we move from there to a global supply chain, which I think is inevitable and where the real underlying opportunity of this is, California is going to be one of those few kind of nodal points around the world where it makes sense economically and from, you know, an environmental perspective to grow this. And in that sense, it has a chokehold position, not just on what happens in the U.S. and now much more in the near term, but in the mid to long term from a global dominance perspective. If you are not in California, you have absolutely missed the opportunity of a lifetime. And so that's kind of our reasoning in being here and where we think this state plays out, and why it made sense to invest strategically first in just dominating the state before we go to, you know, kind of secondary experiments, for example, in Oklahoma or North Dakota.
Right. So that talk of dominating California, and, you know, if you win California, you win Canada, you know, we've talked about that on the podcast, and there's certainly moves being made across the industry, you know, companies showing that and proving that out and feeling like betting big on that thesis to play out. And there's certainly, like, for all the reasons you mentioned, those are all very compelling reasons, clearly. But I'm curious, like, how big of a picture is it? How much room is there? Is it like, Do we know even the total addressable market at this point? Like, as you said, like it just keeps kind of the onion
shifting.
Once you start peeling it, it's, you know, it's not just California, it's beyond California, it's all these things. So how, and as also we watch this consolidation occur across California, kind of how do you think about it? How do you look at it in terms of how big the how much room there is for how many players?
I think it's still so early. Mm-hmm. And that's the reason why the numbers keep changing. And, you know, you can go to, I mean, there's benchmarks that people don't even really think about very much, which is just, you know, again, going back even to the global point, like what's the size of the black market and extrapolate from there, right? It's enormous.
Right.
And then add, you know, a whole layer of eventual kind of biotech and biopharma research and investing and that whole product category eventually evolving. You know, add to it all of the consumer product innovation. I mean, it's not like the black market was producing, you know, high-end vapes 10 years ago. Like, there's this whole proliferation in the product portfolio that adds to something we already understand as being pretty enormous. And so, you know, I guess from, you know, the California perspective, and what do you have here? You got 800 stores for 42 million people. You've got maybe 5 or 6 distributors across the entire state, which, you know, from a geographic and a demographic perspective is one of the most significant in North America. Like, it's still very, very early. And there's still a ton of upside opportunity to capture. You know, there's no Coke or Pepsi yet, even just on the product and the brand side. You can't really even develop that to a large extent in the way that companies are used to, because you have to basically vertically integrate to take your product from one state to another. So when all of that friction comes up, you know, and starts to alleviate, I don't know how you quantify the market. And I would agree with you. I think that it's bigger than people think. But the flip side to that is strategic patience. It's also the timeline to get there and some of the cyclical development you have to go through to unlock it. And that's kind of what we're seeing right now with the consolidation is, you know, finally people starting to, I think, acknowledge the commercial and kind of logistical realities of this space. And, you know, to some extent that was inevitable.
Right. Right. And certainly, like, as we see this consolidation happen and also like the bigger, the better players rising to the top and acquiring some of the companies that for whatever reason, you know, are on the acquiree stage as opposed to the acquirer stage. You know, a lot depends on the supply chain, you know, talking a lot about supply chain, a lot, I think, depends on the supply chain because of how, you know, cannabis works and all the moving parts and also dependent a lot upon, you know, the rules of the state that they're in terms of controlling all aspects of that sometimes. How do you think about that global supply chain, but also just the supply chain in general, just for a cannabis operation to run right? Like, how do you think about that? What do you think that it needs to think about first, second, and third? And how did you think about it in coming into kind of trying to think about that side of things?
Right. Yeah, I think so. It kind of comes down again to what is your theory on the overall trajectory and development of the space? Mm-hmm. And then you microcosmically can go down a number of rabbit holes, like just California alone, right? So in terms of our focus, I think that, you know, we kind of look at it as in the immediate sense, you're basically flipping a Rubik's Cube around to solve a lot of problems that are just idiosyncratic right now due to the kind of the regulatory construct that everybody has to deal with. You know, the fact that there's no operating history or precedent, so everybody is kind of canary in the coal mine. Even the regulators, just to some extent, you know, haven't really fully gotten a handle on their own regulations, right? So you're dealing with solving some of those problems in the immediate term. I'll give you an example. You know, if you're a company in any other widgetized industry and you have an e-commerce play, it's pretty simple what happens. Your customer goes on a site, makes an order, it goes to a warehouse, somebody picks and packs it, it goes in a bin, and at the end of the day, UPS or US Postal Service or FedEx comes and picks it up and delivers it to the front door. That doesn't exist here. There's no FedEx, there's no UPS. So there's like this massive gap in the supply chain, just on the consumer last mile, from the retailer to the end user. So, you know, if you look at like our solution to that, that's why we went into local on-demand delivery. That basically localizes the ability to sell a product and fulfill it to the front door of the end user. It kind of connects from where our retail business ends at the retailer shelves and goes all the way to the front door. That's the kind of workaround you have to deal with in the immediate sense right now to just make the supply chain experience normalized. There are just immediate challenges from a supply chain perspective that just come from all the things we talked about, you know, the fragmentation, regulatory issues, tax burdens, the latent inefficiency, the fact that everybody is trying to figure it out on the fly to a large extent, you know, kind of, you know, balancing that in the immediate sense, because that is what the demand is at the moment with, okay, then how do you anticipate and plan for a more normalized operating environment once some of those idiosyncratic barriers or kind of sources of friction start to come off? And, you know, that's, for example, the reason we chose to absolutely invest and focus myopically at first in California, because that's our long-term play in terms of where we see the global supply chain going and the rest of North America. But in terms of, you know, immediate solutions, you know, just fixing kind of the issue I described relative to the consumer last mile, you know, those are very much outside the box solutions to replicate kind of the normal stuff that you would see commercially in any other industry that isn't subject to all those idiosyncrasies.
Right, right. So getting back to kind of what I brought up at the beginning and that's been in the news, you know, just in the past few days, is this news about Amazon coming out and saying, you know, they're big supporters of cannabis and they're not going to test their workers. And it seems to me, I've been doing this podcast for a couple of years, and it seems to me that a lot of things that affect change are actually people just coming out and saying something and then the market kind of catching up. But I know for like years we've been talking on this podcast, like people have been joking like, well, when Amazon delivers the cannabis to your door, and that's always seemed like really far ahead in the future. And now it seems like, is Amazon like throwing that out there because they want a bunch of people that love cannabis being like, oh, Amazon, you love cannabis too, and like kind of creating that relationship, creating that mood in the marketplace? Like, how do you see, and then I feel like them doing that already kind of propels forward, I bet, a bunch of discussions that are happening in Washington, you know, I would imagine. So how do you think about that? How do you see that playing out? What do you think about Amazon's announcement, you know, vis-a-vis cannabis and retail and all these things that we've been talking about?
You know, it's funny. I think it's actually the other way around. I don't think that it's, I think it's reflective of something Amazon knows as opposed to trying to signal. Yeah. I think at this that's the optimistic case, right? I hope it is, because then it's telegraphing to the market. And, and that makes sense to me in reading the tea leaves, because you're absolutely right. I mean, we've been sitting kind of in the center of the same industry as it evolves. And, you know, going from the days of Jeff Sessions, which was only, 4 years ago, right, to where we are today, and not just all of the organic or grassroots adoption, destigmatization, legalization, you know, at every level from local to state across the country, not just that, but, you know, November, you wind up with a solid blue Washington, right? And it's not like that they haven't been somewhat vocal about this being effectively inevitable. And so I think you're right. I think at this point now, there's probably enough there where we've kind of reached that point. And hopefully what this all indicates is we need to start positioning towards a new customer base now, because we have some insight into what is happening from a legislative perspective, you know, in the relatively near term.
Mm-hmm. And does that kind of development, does that make you think differently or more broadly about who, like, let's say when you talk about acquiring companies and bringing people in or partnering with different, you know, companies, is that something, I mean, I'm sure it is something that you think about, but how do you kind of focus that, that strategy?
It makes you want to go a whole lot faster, right? Yeah. Because the thing that I think everyone, the perception arbitrage we've been in for a while now over the last couple of years has been, you know, the sense that the federal laws could change, enforcement suddenly, you know, reverses and comes down and this whole industry kind of goes away. That was the concern with Jeff Sessions, right? I think everybody knows that's not really the risk. If you're operating on the ground, the real risk is actually Amazon steps into this space sooner than you want it to, because not only is, you know, that a competitor, but theoretically, like for us, that's the kind of acquirer we're building the company towards, right? So it, in a kind of almost counterintuitive way, the whole legalization pathway and then the big balance sheets that ultimately follow with it, they're a gift and a curse. And so if you're looking to scale, you know, essentially to either compete or to be attractive as a target, where the multiple really matters at that point, because now you're talking about Amazon and kind of its peer group, you know, you need to move pretty quickly if you start to hear the clock ticking. And I think that's some of the signs that we're seeing is this is probably going to happen sooner than we think. So make haste while the sun shines, you know, because you don't want a $100 billion balance sheet on your doorstep unless you're ready for it to buy you.
Right, right. So as a CEO of a publicly traded company, how do you think about this valuation picture developing? Like there's been, you know, I think something obviously cannabis investors are thinking a lot about, and some might not be calling themselves cannabis investors at this point because they've been so freaked out. You know, there's a lot of volatility. And then there's this question of what is the true valuation? How are we basing this valuation? Is there going to be an explosion with legalization? Is uplisting going to be the explosion? How do you think about it? And how do you kind of talk to investors about that side of things?
I really think that, and not to be too esoteric about this, I think that...
I like esoteric.
I think that, like, go back to the internet, the dot-com era, right? It's the same type of stuff where it's all new. It's pretty much unprofessionalized. Nobody really, I mean, we just had a conversation, like, what's the real addressable market, right? That's just the reality. I mean, to replace the widget and whatever it is, it was going to be DSL or cable or, you know, I'd go back 30, 40 years, VHS or Betamax. Like there's always these kind of foundational questions in the emergence or the development of a new market. And, you know, so I guess, but that's also what's fun about it to a large extent as well. So I don't know, I guess from my point of view, I think, I kind of lost my train of thought on this, but I think, I think that's kind of...
In terms of like knowing the true value, like, or a, like kind of how, yeah. how do you define the point in the cycle that we find the true value, like, or is this just the psychology of the markets? Or do you feel like there's a moment in our near future that's going to be some kind of cataclysmic, you know, catalyst for the industry, and that will kind of write everything in terms of how we think about things and how we kind of mark and measure things?
Yeah, sorry. So, the, kind of where I was going with that in terms of the conclusion of it is there's going to be more of this coming, right? So there's going to be more... The cross-listing explosion, when that happens, to your point, another round of consolidation. There's been one bright, shiny object after another over the last 5 or 6 years. The lesson sum total of all of that, I believe, is it's distracting. Go back to the fundamentals. Is the management team strong? Does it understand the core business? Can it solve problems on the fly? Because that's the environment we're in. It's not until this at least goes interstate and completes somewhat of a professionalization trajectory truly across the space, it's all, who knows? Yeah. You know, how do you peg real valuation if you can't even get down to what is a reasonable, defensible, addressable market projection for the largest submarket in the world? Like, if you can't wrap your arms around that, it's all speculative. So find, you know, ultimately the kind of core fundamentals, which to some extent are agnostic to value, that's going to continue to fluctuate and be incredibly subjective for at least, I think, another year or two, until you get this to a place where, you know, you have the mass majority of the companies out there being run by professionals that have done other things than cannabis, mm-hmm. to a large extent, you mm-hmm. know?
And do you feel like the year or two it takes to get to a more kind of mature place, or a more solid ground, or a more legal place, more regulated place, do you feel like the longer that takes, the bigger chance that stronger companies have of kind of solidifying their moat and learning what it takes to succeed in kind of an ever-changing but a gradually evolving industry that they probably are under? I mean, I'm kind of answering my own question as I ask it, but
yeah.
But is that how you see it?
Yeah, I think until exactly. It's a constantly moving goalpost, and the, you know, kind of the landscape can't settle and harden until it stops moving.
Right.
And they're just like, they're massive, massive fundamental core questions that still are unanswered. It's not just a question of when does this go legal, it's how does this go legal?
Right.
What does that imply commercially? What does that do to the supply chain? What, I mean, is it, will it be three tiers like alcohol? I mean, there's still so much variability there. So valuations are, I think, to a large extent, still reflective of an illusory landscape because it hasn't settled. And what works today may actually become suddenly, on an almost completely binary basis, totally inviable tomorrow. We don't know.
Right.
And so how do you judge value? I think you look at, again, the things that can remain constant in the middle of all of that fluidity. And there are very few of them, right? It's your fixed assets and your management team. And then ultimately a strategy that you can vet out that hopefully anticipates or can be fluid around all of it too. And that's really kind of, otherwise you're still chasing, you know, a constantly moving target. And until that target settles, I think it's hard to make any decisions on a definitive basis.
Right. We've been talking about kind of the similarities, you know, with the dot-com, the halcyon days of the dot-com era. Kind of getting into the cannabis space, did you see it going away? I know this is a broad and oft-asked question, but kind of, did you see it going away that you were surprised that it didn't go in that way? Or was there something that you were expecting to happen quicker? Is it kind of, what has surprised you and how has it surprised you?
I think that the formative period of it is taking longer than I thought. And I think there's going to be more semi-cycles throughout it, right? So we kind of had, if you go back to the dot-com era, it was kind of V-shaped almost, right? Or W-shaped. Like you had kind of this rise in the NASDAQ through the mid to late 90s. That was all the aspirational case. You have a crash, you know, kind of around 2000, 2001, and all that's exacerbated by a lot of other things, kind of analogous to maybe COVID and the pandemic today. But you had 9/11, you had all the corporate governance scandals, you know, Enron, all of that kind of exacerbating things. And then, but right around that same time, you have companies like Netflix go public and Google go public, and you have the rise of kind of early big tech. And then within a couple of years, social media arrives and it goes forever, right? And I think that was about it. That's kind of the compartmentalization of the development of that space. If you kind of track the cannabis index in somewhat similar way, the early stage almost graphs perfectly. Like we kind of had a huge rise through, you know, almost through Canadian legalization. And then you have a crash that mirrors what happened in 2000, 2001. And then you kind of have a recovery, ironically enough, that seems to be catalyzed by COVID, right? But now you have a rise in, you know, this, all this fragmentation around, for example, now California is in this consolidation phase. And if there's a proliferation of SPACs enabling, you know, even more global consolidation, that's its own semi-cycle. You know, you pointed out a couple that are still coming, legalization, or maybe it's even more incremental, banking, then legalization, you know, and then kind of everything that follows from there. So I think, again, it's almost subsumed in the last point that we made. You have all of these, you still have kind of these semi-cycles working their way through. And maybe it's because this industry hasn't developed like the internet did in a uniform global way. It's been successive as new states have come online, as new countries have come online, and they're all in these varying degrees of maturity. And until that all normalizes or something kind of makes it uniform, it's going to continue to have these kind of boom and bust cycles or these, you know, kind of developmental semi-cycles where it doesn't really feel like the industry is settled yet. And I think it takes a couple of those definitive things like U.S. legalization to finally quiet that noise and have the large landscape harden. So I think that's the difference. I thought it would have been more open and shut. I think we have kind of a longer protracted process that'll be less extreme on average, but it will take longer.
Right. Right. Yeah. I mean, remember the days when it was like when cannabis is legal, that meant one monolithic thing, you know, like, but now it means like a bazillion different things. Yeah. So where do you see Manifest 7 growing? Like what are your goals for this year? How do you see, how are you thinking about the marketplace and what are you looking at?
Yeah, so we're really very, very focused this year on organically scaling our distribution business in California. And I think we see a big opening there to kind of complete, you know, a statewide footprint in the way that we've been envisaging it over the last year or two. So our focus is really actually on the supply chain for the next 6 to 12 months. We have a retail business and delivery as well. But in terms of where we're looking to scale, it's that. And part of that strategy is to a large extent informed by what we've been talking about today, which is we think, you know, at least some kind of reform that's going to relax interstate and banking is coming sooner than we think. So we want to finish California on the distro side, you know, as quickly as we can to be able to start looking at other states, because we think it'll be more porous and, you know, easier to kind of scale out of California from a distribution perspective. So that's really where we're focused in terms of capital investment and time and resources over the next 6 to 12 months.
And when you think about moving beyond California, does it make sense to you to kind of stay in that geographic region, or is the states kind of wide open for you?
Yeah, I think it's almost kind of the application of some of the, you know, the things that you would find out studying, you know, almost kind of historical war, right? It's don't make your supply chain too far away. Mm-hmm. So as much as I love the idea of being, you know, coast to coast, it mm-hmm. still would be optical until you really fill in some of the interstitial parts of the country. So the regional play probably makes a lot more sense in terms of protecting efficiency and shareholder dollars. So, you know, it would be, I think where we're looking is kind of the neighborhood. It's, you know, Nevada, Arizona, Washington, Oregon, mm-hmm. Kind of that whole constituency. Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, speaking about the international picture, as you said, you know, like as the global supply chain develops and opens up, and, you know, we're obviously seeing that to some degree. How do you think about it vis-a-vis Manifest 7? Like, when do you start thinking about, you know, going internationally in a real way? And also, how do you think the market is kind of seeing it? Is it, okay, let's get the US figured out and then kind of take it from their approach, do you think?
I think so. I mean, I think until the US, you know, does something somewhat dramatic relative to legislation, I think it's just, it's hard to take your eyes off of it, right? Or talk about anything else. And it's, I mean, there's a lot that's happened, you know, over the last couple of years globally with other countries, but that news is going to get drowned out, you know, until the US kind of, I think, goes. And I think the bellwether effect of whatever the US chooses to do kind of sets the stage for the rest of the world, right? I mean, if the US goes legal, it's pretty hard. It's pretty hard, I think, to make a case outside of the US that you're not going legal too, right? Fundamentally.
Right, right. And how do you kind of, when you're talking about like building the team that you've built at Manifest 7, how did you approach it? Like we talk, you know, sometimes about what's the balance of a cannabis company and how do you approach it? Like how much business, how much of, you know, people that have experience in the cannabis, how did you approach building your team and building Manifest 7?
It's funny, I joke about it, actually, that it's been a Danny Ocean experience, you know, just kind of like, but it's been opportunistic. I mean, the core group started, you know, kind of already in business together. My chief investment officer, for example, and I have been working together for the better, actually over a decade now. He was a partner in the merchant bank I mentioned, you know, that kind of led to the genesis of the company. Mm-hmm. You know, I think the overall philosophy has been, for a market that has this kind of many, it's like a 360 approach to situational awareness, right? So we have kind of in the C-suite a very good mix of capital markets backgrounds, because there's, you know, a highly transactional environment here. Just look at all the consolidation, you know, kind of corporate governance. So some real grown-ups in the room. And then, you know, kind of beyond that, where do you layer in the right cannabis expertise to make sure that you have, you know, kind of the idiosyncratic aspects of this particular product category covered. Mm-hmm. And, you know, so op side kind of comes from either, you know, kind of the channel background or cannabis specifically. The C-suite is very kind of, you know, I think more of the capital markets, corporate finance, transactional complexion of the company. And there's a good balance there to make sure that we kind of have the right expertise around the table, you know, given all the different things that happen in this space and in the African temple. Mm-hmm.
And then when you're like acquiring a company or partnering with a company, Is it management first? Is it the strategy of how it fits into how you kind of want things to go in terms of your vision? How do you is it a combination? How do you think about bringing that on?
It really is case by case, you know. Mm-hmm. And so we have a couple of transactions that are underway now, and you know they're pretty varied in terms of the investment thesis, right? So in one case, we are truly buying the company for the management team. You know, there's some fixed assets that come with it. It is a little bit of bolt-on revenue, but we're really buying the company for that reason. You know, in other cases, it's, you know, just bolting on the revenue to serve a capital markets objective or just to get to profitability faster. You know, in some cases, it's just the strategic assets. In particular, when you're talking about kind of assembling an infrastructure, you know, the licensing and the real estate that comes with it become kind of chunky assets that, you know, have a lot of value potentially depending upon the overall objective. So it's a mix. And it's not to say that because we're engaged in one right now, you know, that the management team can't have enough value to actually rationalize the deal. Mm-hmm. And that's, you know, scarcity value around talent in the space as well.
Right. I'm curious, and this is kind of winding down. I'm curious just your thoughts on the developing retail picture and how much you think COVID affects retail permanently and how cannabis retail looks, just kind of like your broad thoughts, visions of how that goes and develops.
Yeah, I think from a broad perspective, it's kind of subject to the same dynamics as everything else. You know, it's still early.
Right.
You know, the assumption is that the kind of neighborhood dispensary is going to be the retail model forever. I mean, look at Planet 13. They're actually making a play at expanding a big box model. You know, we're focused on delivery. If you look at the way that, you know, pretty much everyone on the planet has been habituated over the last 20 years, on-demand is pretty significant, right? So I think it's still early in terms of how the channel develops. And then you have kind of the regulatory questions too, like at what point does this get legalized and destigmatized enough that, you know, as a distributor, I'm selling packs of, you know, marijuana of you know, joints basically into 7-Elevens and, you know, liquor stores. Right. So there's a lot of runway left there. In terms of COVID, I think COVID has been one of the most interesting kind of factors on the development of the space. And I think when we look back on it, it's going to be viewed as even more significant. But in my view, the fact that you had California go essential when the shelter in place orders came down, you look at the numbers, even the correction in the capital markets, like you started to see that V-shape hit as people, I think, started to understand this product category is not going away. Yeah. There is nothing but ever increasing demand for it. People are willing to prioritize it in the middle of a global crisis with toilet paper and sanitizer. Like, that's a major statement.
Yeah.
And I think everybody noticed that, from the politicians to the operators to the investors, the capital markets. And, you know, if you were looking for something to validate this and say this is truly real and it's not going anywhere because people just won't let it, it was the COVID effect.
Yeah.
that sent that signal to everyone.
Yeah, it's wild. I mean, speaking of getting esoteric, I mean, this is like one of my favorite things to talk about is COVID was obviously like such a huge disruptor in a lot of really painful ways. But then it disrupted things that were like, wow, how was this going to get disrupted to this degree in terms of like really breaking people's minds wide open in terms of it? And there's like a few examples of that, cannabis certainly being one of them. And I remember also it was just like right at the beginning of COVID and hitting kind of globally. And hearing that it went essential in California, and you're like, wow, this really means something. And it kept meaning more and more. And I think you're right. I think it is a significant kind of marker along the way. It's interesting about how things develop like that. You kind of think it's coming from one way and it comes from an entirely different direction. Sturgis, I've really enjoyed this conversation, the esoteric, the fundamental, the financial, the mundane. I feel like we've covered it all. I've really enjoyed talking to you. Tell listeners where they can find Manifest 7 and ways if they want to contact you or hear more about Manifest 7.
Yeah, best place is our website, Manifest 7, and that's the numeral, not the word, manifest7.com. And then that handle works pretty much in searching all of our social as well.
Awesome. Sturgis, thanks so much for joining us today. I really appreciate it.
No, really appreciate it too. This was a lot of fun. Thanks so much for having me.
Thanks so much for listening to the Cannabis Investing Podcast. Subscribe or follow us on Seeking Alpha, Libsyn, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Play, or Stitcher. And we'd really appreciate it if you could leave us a review on Apple Podcasts. It helps other investors find our show. If you have feedback or questions, we'd love to hear from you at Rena plus the plus sign CANPOD at SeekingAlpha.com. That's RENA plus CANPOD at SeekingAlpha.com. Thanks so much for listening, and see you next time.